In our study of Mark, we have a lengthy text today, the whole way from chapter 4, verse 35 to chapter 5, verse 43. I'm going to begin reading in chapter 5, verse 21. And when Jesus crossed again in the boat to the other side, a great crowd gathered around him, and he was beside the sea. Then one of the rulers of the synagogue, Jairus by name, and seeing him, he fell down at his feet and implored him earnestly, saying, "My little daughter is at the point of death. Come, lay your hands on her that she may be made well and live." And he went with him. And a great crowd followed him and thronged about him. And there was a woman who had a discharge of blood for 12 years, who had suffered much under many physicians, and had spent all that she had, and was no better, but rather grew worse. She had heard the reports about Jesus, came up behind him in the crowd, and touched his garment. For she said, "If I touch even his garments, I will be made well." And immediately the flow of blood dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. And Jesus, perceiving in himself that power had gone out from him, immediately turned about in the crowd and said, "Who touched my garments?" And his disciples said to him, "You see the crowd pressing around you, and yet you say, 'Who touched me?'" And he looked around to see who had done it. And the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling and fell down before him and told the whole truth. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease." While he was still speaking, there came from the ruler's house some who said, "Your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further?" But overhearing what they said, Jesus said to the ruler of the synagogue, "Do not fear, only believe." And he allowed no one to follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. They came to the house of the ruler of the synagogue, and Jesus saw a commotion, people weeping and wailing loudly. And when he had entered the he said to them, "Why are you making a commotion and weeping? The child is not dead, but sleeping." And they laughed at him. But he put them all outside and took the child's father and mother and those who were with him and went in where the child was. Taking her by the hand, he said to her, "Talitha kumi," which means, "Little girl, I say to you, arise." And immediately the girl got up and began walking, for she was 12 years of age. And they were immediately overcome with amazement. And he strictly charged them so that no one should know this. And he told them, "Give her something to eat." Now we're going to do a quick run through four miracles of Jesus today. Mark has lumped several of them together here. So we'll do an overview of each one. Now Jesus did miracles for two reasons, perhaps among others, but the two primary reasons. One was compassion. He saw what people were going through. He saw the difficulty. He felt their pain, if we could use that cliche. And he responded to that pain by healings, by raising from the dead, whatever it would be. But secondly, and more importantly, it was done, and John uses this term all the time throughout his gospel, they were done as signs, indicating who he was, that he was indeed God, that he had come from God to be Messiah here on this earth. And in that exchange that we read with the Pharisees back in John 10, in verse 37, "Do not believe me unless I do what my Father does. But if I do it, even though you do not believe me, believe the miracles that you may know and understand that the Father is in me and I in the Father." So we have four of these instances before us today. They're done to demonstrate that he was from God and that he was God. The leaders found that extremely difficult to accept, and therefore they continued to reject him, even at times threatening his life. Well, the first is the calming of the sea. You find that back in the end of chapter 4. Now, let's recall that the men in the boat, these were Jesus' disciples in the boat, and when this storm came up, these were hardened fishermen for the most part. They knew the Sea of Galilee like the back of their hand. They were aware and accustomed to the quirks of that body of water. And it had this this propensity for whipping up serious squalls in a flash, totally unexpected. Now, this must have been a particularly bad one for it to strike fear in them as it had. They were in definite fear of their lives, and the waves were, you know, crashing in over the boat. Try and imagine it. You know, some are there straining at the oars to keep the boat going in the right direction. Others probably with a bucket or so trying to bail out, but they were losing. There was more coming in than they could get out of the boat. So they go and wake Jesus, who was sleeping. Now, on the good side, they saw him as the only one who could really do something to help them. So they go to him in absolute desperate fear. In the bad side, though, this still shows some degree of lack of faith. There was a song we used to sing in church when I was a kid. It was in the hymnal. Maybe some of you know it. It was entitled "Master, the Tempest is Raging." It's all about this incident. It goes like this: "Master, the tempest is raging. The billows are tossing high. The sky is o'ershadowed with blackness. No shelter or help is nigh. Carest thou not that we perish? How canst thou lie asleep when each moment so madly is threatening a grave in the angry deep?" But then in the refrain, the mood changes. "The wind and the waves shall obey thy will. Peace, be still. Whether the wrath of the storm-tossed sea, or demons, or men, or whatever it be, no water can swallow the ship where lies the master of ocean and earth and skies." That's the faith they didn't have. "They all shall sweetly obey thy will. Peace, be still. Peace, be still." So Jesus effortlessly rebukes the wind and the waves, simply saying, "Peace, be still." Now think of how eerie that next moment would have been. There you are, battling for your life, waves crashing everywhere, the wind howling, and whoo, silence. Total calm. Sea of Galilee more placid than they ever saw it before. Maybe the only thing you hear is a little bit of those tiny little waves lapping against the side of the boat. That would be very strange. And then Jesus asks them why they had so little faith. And again, silence. At least there's no answer recorded. They don't respond to that. We're told that they were terrified. Literally, it says that they feared a great fear. And it seems to me we talked about that not too long ago, but that in Hebrew and Aramaic, and even in Greek to some degree, repetition of a term intensified it. So fearing is one thing, but fearing a fear is already intense, and then they add the Greek word mega. So they feared a mega fear. So they were scared before with the storm, but now they were face to face with someone who could do only what God could do, and they're scared out of their wits. They're absolutely terrified. They're fearing a great fear. So in this, Jesus proclaims his authority and his deity. And they were beside themselves. They didn't know what to do. Well, they pull up on the shore in the region of the Gerasenes. Depending on your version, it may say Gadarenes. There's a number of different terms that are used. But it's on the eastern side of the Sea of Galilee. Kind of comes almost to a point on the southern end. It's on the eastern side of that point. And what they're confronted with next sounds almost like something out of a horror movie. It's a demoniac, but not just a run-of-the-mill demoniac. This guy was frightening, incredibly strong, running around unclothed, crying out from the tombs and the mountains. You can just imagine that at night, out among the tombs and that sort of thing. It gives you the creeps. He's bloodied from self-mutilation. He'd been bound with chains and shackles before and just broke them? This was somebody you didn't want to meet up with. But they pull up to shore, and what happens? He begins to run in their direction. Now, they were scared in the water. I'm sure they were scared again when this guy begins to approach them. But then the unexpected happens. When he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and fell down before him, and crying out in a loud voice, he says, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I adjure you, by God, do not torment me." I mean, you're there, you're afraid of this monster coming at you, and now you're like, with what he said. You're stunned. Now, we've seen several times already in the study of Mark how Jesus demonstrated his power and authority over the demonic world. Now, here was a case of just genuine wretchedness. He had no hope of freeing himself from his spiritual enslavement. But even in his darkness, he made the only move that had any promise of hope and help. All that he does is come to Jesus. There's a lesson there for us, isn't it? In the context of our darkness, we can't figure out which way to go or what to do. Better go to Jesus, seems to me. Your boat's about ready to sink. What did the disciples do? You go to Jesus. This man who was forced to live out apart from civilization, he comes to Jesus. Now, just a brief aside. In Matthew records that there were two men. Mark and Luke speak of only one. Is that a discrepancy? Is that a problem with the Bible? Well, Matthew must have had a separate source of information as he wrote his gospel and did not depend exclusively on Mark for what he wrote. But even so, it's not a discrepancy in the sense that if I come home someday and I tell Joanne, I ran into Josh at Costco today, I'm entirely truthful, even though his wife Katie was with him and I didn't mention her. Doesn't mean I didn't see Katie. Doesn't mean that there wasn't a second person there. I'm only referring to my son. And same thing is true of Mark's account. That it's not a discrepancy. And that second man doesn't appear to be key to the story anyway. So the man comes to Jesus. He cries out, seeking not to come under judgment. And Jesus orders the spirit, but then he inquires about his name. He says, be gone kind of thing. And the man responds, "My name is Legion, for we are many." So he was plagued with perhaps a legion of demons. Now, at this time, a Roman legion was about 5,000 men. Is he saying by this that he had 5,000 demons in him? I don't know that we ought to necessarily construe that, but certainly we're not talking about two or three, hundreds perhaps, maybe thousands, but you get the impression that the man was deeply, deeply possessed and oppressed under this demonic activity. Now, the demons request to be sent into a herd of pigs rather than being sent away to the pit. So Jesus does so, and the pigs immediately destroy themselves, but the man is restored. Now, a bit later, he's seated there clothed and in his right mind, and he wants to go with Jesus. But Jesus sends him back to his family and to his town to declare the mercy of God. Now, we clearly can see how a man like that would want to live out a life of gratitude. Going from such depth of darkness and enslavement, he'd be overjoyed for a long, long time. But haven't we been redeemed from destruction and darkness as well? So we too should be declaring God's mercy and thanking God for what he has done. and we ought not to be forgetting it so readily. Well, the third miracle is the woman with the blood issue. Now, it's embedded within the narrative of another miracle. Jesus is on his way to do a healing, and she interrupts him. She had tried everything, went from doctor to doctor, spent a fortune, and she still found no relief. Matter of fact, Mark tells us she was getting worse. Now, recall also that a malady of this sort would render her unclean. So for 12 years, she had never been to the temple. She was forbidden. So there was more than just the physical malady. There was also this great spiritual connection to it. Now, she exercises enormous faith. She figures, if I can just touch his clothes, I can be healed. She does, and she is, immediately. Jesus responds, knowing that something had happened. He asks, "Who touched me?" Now, the disciples, I can't hear it any other way than almost a mocking type of ridicule. You're in the midst of a crowd. What do you mean, who touched me? Kind of question. But with that, the woman was exposed. She was hoping to do this in secret and get away. Why, we don't know. But now it's revealed. And now she is front and center. The spotlight is on her, and she falls down before him trembling and explains what she had done. But notice the marvelous compassion with which Jesus speaks. "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace. Be healed of your disease." No guilt trips, no nothing, just pure compassion. This in particular speaks of enormous compassion on Jesus' part, but so does the one with the demoniac. Great compassion there. Jesus alleviates the distress of the personal situations of these people, but at the same time, pointing powerfully that he is the God-man. This is the Holy One of Israel. He is not just a miracle worker. He is Messiah. The demoniac and this woman at this point would know that for certain. Well, the final one is the one with Jairus' daughter. And a wonderfully heartwarming one. Any of us who know folks who have lost lost a child, you long for this kind of thing to have happened in their case. Now, Jairus is a man that we only hear of in this context. He was ruler of a synagogue, probably the one in Capernaum. We're not told, but good chance of that. His daughter was dying, so in desperation, he too, like the demoniac, he comes to Jesus. Jesus goes with him. But on the way, someone comes from his home. "Your daughter is dead. Don't bother." With that, they believed it was all over. Nothing else could be done. Now, this is probably not the first time Jesus had raised someone from the dead. We can't always be certain of the timeline of things, but Luke, most scholars believe that Luke is the most chronological in his presentation of the life of Christ. In chapter 7 of Luke, we have the record of his raising the widow of Nain's son, and then he puts in Jairus' daughter in chapter 8. So, with the best information we have, this is probably at least the second raising of a dead person, but who knows how many there were that were never recorded. We just don't know that, but probably not the first time that happened. So Jairus is informed of his daughter's death, but it's what Jesus says next that's at least intriguing, maybe perplexing, maybe shocking. He says to the ruler of the synagogue, "Do not fear, only believe." Now, what's he supposed to do with that? He came to Jesus with some degree of hope, or he wouldn't have come at all. So he exercised some faith, but now what could he do? She's dead. The man who brought the news was right. Why bother the teacher anymore? Well, Jesus continues to walk with him toward his house. What was Jairus thinking at that point? For what purpose? Or was he just too struck with grief at that point? His thoughts were all just a jumble, wasn't really thinking much of anything straight. Or was he thinking how useless it all seemed? Was he questioning, why did I even bother coming to him in the first place? Don't we have a similar problem to that? We might exercise faith up to a certain point, but when things don't go the way we had hoped, do we give up? Do we start to grumble, get angry with God? Because the hopes that we had come crashing down? We don't know how Jairus was responding, but at least he continues to walk with Jesus back home. They arrive at the house, and the professional mourners had already shown up. And they were hired to come and just make a big ruckus, to weep and wail, and at times they would bang on things just to make a ruckus, basically, out of their mourning. Well, he enters the house and he says to him, "Why are you making commotion and weeping? The child is not dead, but sleeping." Now, I don't think it rhymed in Aramaic when Jesus said it, but it does in the ESV anyway. So they immediately turn from mourning to mockery. They laughed at what he said, and he put them all out, except for Peter, James, and John, and her parents. So he goes to the girl, he says, "Child, arise," and immediately she sits up, starts to walk around. There again, what marvelous compassion for these two grieving parents. But at the same time, what a marvelous declaration of his person. I'm certain Jairus and his wife were totally overwhelmed. How do you go from that kind of deep grief to the soaring ecstasy of the next moment? I mean, we're not built for those kinds of transitions. You see, we all have various deficiencies in our faith. We're reluctant to trust God the way we ought. In our natural selves, we're devoid of that kind of faith, but God grants us the gift of it. But even then, we don't always exercise it all that well. The disciples lacked faith in the storm, and who would have believed that wild demoniac could have been healed? The woman with the bleeding actually stands out as the one who really trusted. But even then, why the fear and the trembling? But you too, me too, all of us need our faith to be revived. We need our hope in Christ to be front and center. You see, as marvelous as this miracle of raising the little girl was, Christ has done even more for us. He granted us eternal life. We were dead in trespasses and sins, the Bible said, but Christ made us alive. There's a powerful song, I've probably made mention of it before, by Don Francisco, who was a kind of a popular contemporary Christian musician back in the early 80s. Francisco's real claim to fame was taking Bible stories and just making them live before you. Never cared a whole lot for his voice, but his lyrical content very often was powerful. He wrote one about this situation. The last two stanzas go like this. "Then he called his three disciples that were with him on the way. He led them and my wife and me to where our daughter lay." It's written obviously from Jairus' perspective. "He took her by the hand. He told her, 'Child, arise.' And the words were barely spoken when she opened up her eyes. She rose and walked across the room and stood there at her sides. My wife knelt down and held her close, and at last she really cried. Then Jesus told us both to see our daughter had some food. But as to how her life was saved, not to speak a word. Not to speak a word. I got to tell somebody. I got to tell somebody. I got to tell somebody. I got to tell somebody what Jesus did for me. And he goes on with that for quite a while in the song. But you get the sense from it how just busting inside he was with what had been done for he and his family. And he wanted to tell somebody. We, on the other hand, are to tell the story of what Jesus has done for us. It's no longer a secret. That whatever Jesus' reasons were for telling people not to tell, that's all been lifted. We are free to tell whoever will listen. Jesus, the God-man, lived and died and rose again to make atonement for guilty sinners like us. He accomplished that, and now he deals with us as though we were righteous. He has granted us faith. He's granted us the Holy Spirit, so let's exercise that faith. Let's trust him when all seems lost. Let's trust him when we consider the seemingly hopeless situation of the lost ones that we know. Let's trust him to use us to speak the truth in love to others who need to know. We too need to tell somebody. We have a marvelous story to tell. A story that encompasses Christmas, Good Friday, Easter. Jesus is alive. He has made full atonement for us. We're granted that status of righteousness, fully accepted into the family of God. We got to tell somebody. Try and find that song on YouTube and give it a listen. It'll encourage your heart. But we got to tell somebody. So Christ has declared again for us his love in the sacrament that's before us. So let's come and partake and rejoice.